the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, says world powers are using sanctions as a weapon against other countries. EU leaders agreed to ban about 90% of Russian oil imports to the bloc while cutting off its largest bank from the SWIFT system. Also ahead, US President Joe Biden says he would not send rocket systems to Ukraine that could hit targets deep inside Russia, despite urgent requests from Kiev. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says world powers are weaponizing sanctions against other countries, but such bans can be crippled by focusing on domestic power and capacities. In a meeting with the visiting Tajik president, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran has made good progress in various fields, not just despite, but also because of Western coercive measures. The leader said Tehran and Dushanbe can expand their ties much further than the current level, and the relations must undergo fundamental transformation. Elsewhere, Ayatollah Khamenei called for the formation of an inclusive government in Afghanistan, stressing that Iran and Tajikistan are both concerned about the spread of terrorism and Takfiri groups in the region. For his part, Imam Ali Rahman also called for the improvement of Iran-Tajikistan ties. He said his country seeks peace and stability in Afghanistan, ruled by a government with the participation of all ethnicities. University professor Fuad Izzadi says the leader is sending a message of resilience to the United States by downplaying the impact of sanctions amid talks to revive the 2015 deal.
Well, I think the section of Dr. Khamenei's speech on sanctions had two purposes. One, it's customary for world leaders, when they meet, they share experiences, both positive experiences, negative experiences. So this is an achievement of Iran to be able to grow become a leader in many scientific fields at the same time that the country has been under sanctions. So that's the number one reason. It's an ordinary thing to do. I think the second reason Ayatollah Khamenei talked about sanctions is with regard to what's going on with JCPOA. As you know, the United States government, the Biden administration, is basically following the Trump lead when it comes to Iran. Biden is basically implementing Trump's policies, and the negotiations are not going fast anywhere. So the message, I think, the second reason this issue is raised is to give this idea to the other side, that Iran can live with sanctions, and Iran has been able to overcome difficulties. And the basic message is that even if the United States wants to continue that policy of sanctioning Iran, it may actually have some benefits in the long run for the country.
Tajikistan's President Imam Ali Rahman is in Tehran for a two-day visit. As our correspondent Yusuf Jalali reports, the two Persian-speaking countries have agreed to ramp up their trade despite challenges created by U.S. sanctions on Iran.
Shaking hands of friendship in Tehran, Tajikistan's president, Imam Ali Rahman, is on a two-day trip to Iran upon an invitation by his Iranian counterpart, Ibrahim Raisi. The first day was the busiest day, which saw the two sides signing cooperation documents in a range of fields, from energy and environment to tourism and urban development.
Today, Mr. President's visit to Iran and the signing of the new MOUs between the two countries will definitely bring about a giant leap in the two sides' relations.
Today, we also followed up on the implementation of agreements signed earlier in Tajikistan that draw the roadmap for Iran and Tajikistan's economic and political cooperation until 2030.
The two sides also talked on regional developments, both sharing the same stance that Afghanistan needs to be ruled by an all-inclusive government.
Establishing a broad-based government in Afghanistan that includes all ethnic and social groups is essential to promoting peace and stability in that country.
20 years of NATO and U.S. presence in Afghanistan has had no outcome other than war, bloodshed, and destruction, and the future of Afghanistan must be determined by the people of Afghanistan themselves.
Tajikistan has been a strong supporter of Iran's full membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or the SCO. In September last year, the Tajik president invited Raisi to his country when Iran was finally approved as a full member of the SCO, a major bloc of Asian states that was launched in 2001 by China, Russia, and Central Asian republics, with the goal of promoting cooperation in politics, trade, and economy.
In the early days of my 10 years as president, I traveled to Tajikistan both to take part in the Shanghai summit and to visit Tajikistan. That trip was a turning point in the two countries' ties, so that today we have witnessed a fourfold increase in our bilateral trade.
Despite their historical, linguistic, cultural, and religious commonalities, Tehran and Dushanbe have not maintained a remarkable trade partnership. In 2020, the trade volume between the two countries was around $57 million, down from a high of $300 million in 2013. Raisi's last year visit to Tajikistan paved the way for a surge in the two sides' economic ties, pushing the annual trade up fivefold to $130 million. The two set a target of $500 million for annual bilateral trade, despite the challenges of U.S. sanctions on Iran.
Closer ties with neighbors has been on top of Ebrahim Raisi's agenda since he took office almost a year ago, as part of his ambitions to untie his country's economy from the fate of the 2015 deal. As a country that shares many concerns and commonalities with Iran, Tajikistan is on the same page with Tehran to open a new chapter in their partnership. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Turning to some developing news now, EU leaders have agreed to ban two-thirds of Russia's oil imports into the bloc, falling short of imposing an all-out embargo on Russian oil. EU Council President Charles Michel claims the embargo will cut a, quote, huge source of financing for Russia's war machine. The ban affects Russian oil imports via sea, but pipeline deliveries are exempted. European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen says almost 90% of all Russian oil imports will be banned by the end of the year. The deal was aimed at a compromise with the opponents of the embargo within the bloc, chiefly Hungary. There was also opposition from Slovakia, the Czech Republic, and Bulgaria, who said they could not halt Russian oil imports. The sixth package of EU sanctions on Moscow since the beginning of the Ukraine war will also cut off the largest Russian bank from the SWIFT system. Three more Russian state-owned broadcasters are also banned, while an individual allegedly responsible for war crimes in Ukraine is also blacklisted. U.S. President Joe Biden says he won't send rocket systems to Ukraine that could hit targets deep inside the Russian territory. Reacting to Biden's remarks, Deputy Chairman of Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, described his decision as rational. Biden's remark comes despite urgent requests from Ukraine that wants mobile batteries of rockets with a range of up to 300 kilometers. Biden's decision has also raised eyebrows among U.S. Republicans. Senator Lindsey Graham has accused the Biden administration of being intimidated by the Russian rhetoric and betraying Ukraine. Russia had earlier warned that any foreign arms delivered to Ukraine would be fair game for its strikes. Elsewhere, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has released footage showing the seizure of two Greek tankers in the Persian Gulf over maritime violations. The video shows IRGC heliborne special forces boarding and taking control of the Greek ships. The vessels were impounded on Friday. Shipping sources said one tanker was carrying an oil cargo bound for the United States, while the other was heading for Greece. The incident came just days after Greece confiscated the cargo of an Iranian-flagged oil tanker and delivered it to the U.S. The Iranian Foreign Ministry summoned the Swiss and Greek envoys over the issue. Switzerland represents U.S. interests in Iran. The ministry slammed the U.S. violation of international law and maritime conventions governing free navigation and trade. It also demanded the immediate release of the seized ship and its cargo. The head of the Iranian Islamic Seminaries, Ayatollah Ali Reza Arafi, is in Rome for an official visit. During his trip to Italy, the prominent Iranian cleric met with Pope Francis and members of the Shia community. Max Cividi has more from the Italian capital.
On Monday, head of the Iranian Islamic Seminaries, Ayatollah Ali Reza Arafi, held meetings with the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, and high-ranking prelates at the Vatican. The prominent Iranian cleric presented the pontiff with refined artifacts from his hometown of Maybod in Yazd province and the holy city of Qom. After that, the two religious personalities held private talks. Iran and the Vatican established full diplomatic ties in 1954, and the bond has remained uninterrupted ever since. Not many reflect on the fact that Iran and the Vatican both represent spiritual traditions that have much more in common than might initially come to mind. Ayatollah Arafi's visit to the Holy See coincided with the commemorations of the 33rd anniversary of the demise of Imam Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. On Sunday evening, Arafi paid a visit to the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center, where he met with members of Rome's Shia community. Here, the cleric attended a commemoration of the late leader of Iran's 1979 revolution.
All thinkers who came before Imam Khomeini had predicted an end for the age of spirituality, and faithful from all religions, including the Muslims, had lost hope in the spiritual ways of living. Imam Khomeini took Islam and all religions to a more elevated spirituality, restoring their hope.
The commemoration held at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center was also attended by Iran's diplomats and representatives of Rome's Palestinian community. There was much anticipation at the center for Ayatollah Arafi's visit.
Ayatollah Arafi's visit to Italy and to our center is very meaningful. We are honored to have him with us, and this spurs us to further study the thinking of Imam Khomeini and to ask ourselves what the role of the Shias is in the community.
In November 2020, Ayatollah Arafi sent a letter to the Holy See in which he expressed his concerns regarding the insults made against the Prophet Muhammad and the hatred expressed by some magazines, journalists, and political figures in different societies. In response to this letter, 3 months later, Pope Francis replied to the Iranian cleric, saying he is concerned for those affected by aggression and insults of religious figures, symbols, and sentiments. Max Civili, Rome.
Multiple rockets have targeted an Iraqi military base that hosts foreign troops, including U.S. soldiers in the country's western Anbar province. A source from the so-called U.S.-led coalition said 5 rockets struck the Ayn al-Assad base. However, an Iraqi security source said only 3 rockets fell near the base. The attack has caused no casualties or material damage. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. U.S. diplomatic and military assets and personnel in Iraq have repeatedly come under attack in recent years amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments. Damascus slams Ankara's plan to establish a safe zone in northern Syria as an act of aggression and extension of Turkey's ethnic cleansing policy in that area. Syria says the measures taken by Turkey over the past few days have caused civilian casualties and done massive damage to public and private property, including critical infrastructure. Syria describes Turkey's offensive as a shameful act of aggression that has displaced dozens of families from their homes and villages. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said last week that his country was planning to establish a so-called safe zone along 30 kilometers of its border with Syria. Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's sovereignty. Elsewhere, campaigners are threatening legal action if Britain's Home Office does not make public a damning report that claims 30 years of racist immigration laws caused the Windrush scandal. The 52-page document is said to conclude that British immigration legislation is designed to reduce the UK's non-white population, and fears are another Windrush-type scandal is inevitable unless there is immediate action. Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Doubts about Boris Johnson's ability to survive as Britain's Prime Minister and fears that the Tories are now on a terminal electoral slide grew as party grandee Sir Bob Neill said the combination of collapsing trust in the Prime Minister coupled with a lack of clarity over what the Conservatives stood for had created a toxic mix in the minds of voters. We now present you an article written jointly by Toby Helm, Michael Savage and Philip Inman. The piece is titled, Party Grandees Warn Boris Johnson is Trashing Tory Identity. As more British MPs called Boris Johnson to resign as Prime Minister, senior Tories warned recently he has plunged the Conservative Party into an acute identity crisis as a result of the Partygate scandal and U-turns over tax policy. Former Tory leader Ian Duncan Smith told The Observer his party had been left with an enormous identity problem because it had raised taxes instead of cutting them under Boris Johnson and the Chancellor Rishi Sunak, undermining a core Tory message that had helped win its successive general elections. Doubts about Boris Johnson's ability to survive as Prime Minister and fears that the Tories are now on a terminal electoral slide grew as party grandee Sir Bob Neill said the combination of collapsing trust in the Prime Minister coupled with a lack of clarity over what the Conservatives stood for had created a toxic mix in the minds of voters. Sir Bob Neill called on Friday, 27th of May, for Boris Johnson to go. Recently, two more MPs, former Health Minister Steve Bryan and Anne-Marie Morris, said they had also lost confidence in Prime Minister Boris Johnson, taking the total who have gone public to 24. Several others are understood to have written letters of no confidence to 1922 Chair Sir Graham Brady without going public, and more have privately indicated they will do so. If 54 or more MPs submit letters of no confidence to Sir Graham Brady, a leadership contest will be triggered. One rebel MP said, I reckon we're in the 40s. Another added, we're just a few off. Thursday, 26th of May and Friday, 27th of May, there was a mood of relief bordering on jubilation in Downing Street as Boris Johnson and his team believed they had survived the publication of a damaging report on Partygate by the senior civil servant Sue Gray, and then switched focus onto measures to address the cost of living crisis on Thursday. While a £15 billion package of measures announced by Rishi Sunak was broadly welcomed, many Tories were unhappy that the government funded part of it by performing a massive U-turn, which saw it adopt Labour's plan for a windfall tax on the profits of oil and gas companies. Ian Duncan Smith said that instead of imposing a tax rise on businesses, the Chancellor Rishi Sunak should have cut taxes for middle and lower earners and restored the Tory reputation as a low taxation party. Ian Duncan Smith said, he had the headroom not to do a windfall tax. Getting growth going is the priority. We have to avoid recession, and to do that, we have to lower taxes and get people spending. Ian Duncan Smith added, Conservatives believe in lower taxes, leaving people with more of their own money because they make the best choices. Unless we get back to this approach and cut taxes in the autumn budget, we're in real trouble. He said the Tories now risked earning a reputation for being a high-tax, big-state party, having also raised national insurance in breach of a manifesto commitment. He noted, I don't just think we have a bit of an identity problem, we have a massive identity problem. Gavin Barwell, the former Tory MP who served as Theresa May's chief of staff at No. 10 Downing Street, said the party's electoral prospects under Boris Johnson were grim. By failing to take action against the Prime Minister, approximately 60% of the public think should resign, Conservative MPs are sleepwalking to defeat at the next election. The latest opinion poll for The Observer finds that 56% of all British voters, including 32% of 2019 Tory voters, believe that Boris Johnson should resign. The opinion poll was conducted after publication of Sue Gray's report. Oliver Heald, the Tory MP for North East Hertfordshire, told constituents that he was talking with fellow MPs about what happens next. He added, "I think it will take 2 or 3 weeks to know the answer. Key by-elections in Wakefield and in Tiverton and Honiton take place in 3 weeks." Former Cabinet Minister Robert Buckland said on Saturday, 28th of May, that changes will have to be made if the party suffers heavy defeats. The Liberal Democrats say many of those calling for Boris Johnson to resign are in Tory seats that they are targeting. The Deputy Leader of the Liberal Democrats, Daisy Cooper, said Conservative MPs who spend months defending Boris Johnson over Partygate are now finally acting because they're worried about losing their seats. Daisy Cooper added, "This by-election in Tiverton and Honiton is a chance to send a clear message that people won't stand for Boris Johnson's lies and law-breaking and that he has to go. If we can overturn the huge Tory majority, the trickle of letters of no confidence in the Prime Minister could turn into a flood." Johnson caused further astonishment on Friday, 27th of May, just 2 days after declaring himself to have been humbled by Sue Gray's report, when it was announced that he had written parts of the ministerial code of conduct so that ministers no longer have to resign for minor breaches of the code. He also removed a section of the code which referred to ethics. The Labour Party on Saturday announced it would hold an opposition day debate in which the party would pledge to strengthen the code of conduct. In a further potential blow to the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, doubts are being raised recently about whether the windfall tax will raise anywhere near the £5 billion that the Chancellor claimed it would on Thursday, 26th of May. The left-of-centre Commonwealth think tank said he may only raise a fraction of that sum because of complex rules which allow investments to be offset against profits. The warning comes after the Liberal Democrats said delays to the tax's introduction meant he had missed out on £3 billion from the extraordinary profits reported by oil and gas firms in 2021 and another £8 billion so far this year.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Well, this is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Viewpoint. And here, I am your host. This is Asma. And I'm very pleased to have two very dear guests, Brother Ali and Sheikh Ruhullah. And previously we talked about death and the following issues related to it. And now since it was a very interesting topic, we couldn't live it. So we are following that discussion right now. A human being has got, as far as we know, has got two dimensions, the physical part and the metaphysical part, which is the soul. And we agree upon that fact. Now, the question is, the experience that of these people have in their life a sort of virtual death before the actual death, and they have the chance to come back and retell their stories. How could we justify these experiences? Are they hallucinations? Are they illusions? Or they're just actual things?
Actually, we cannot call them illusions. They might be true and might not be true, because we cannot actually verify the experiences of others. I cannot verify and approve your own experiences, and you cannot exactly do the same for me. So we have been advised by Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahj al-Balagha, the peak of eloquence, to think of the death before you die. And you see, throughout the Nahj al-Balagha, we see lots of recommendations of Imam, that Imam very delicately and accurately defines how this transition is going to happen. And when we think about these, recommendations, something might even come to the pupil. When you think too much about something, it might even come to yourself.
Yes.
See? And
that's why some people call it illusion, because they say you think too much about something, you focus upon it, and that happens to you.
Yeah, I've heard in the biography of Sayyid al-Qadi rahmatullah alayhi, that he once asked that, he has been asked about such issues, that where do you know these issues, where did you experience such things? He said, while I was in graveyards studying Nahj al-Balagha, and those phrases of
it's
Imam.
Very interesting.
Those phrases of Imam about the death and reminding the life after this life.
That's going into the depth of each line.
Yeah. Talking about the reality of such experiences, yes, they might be real. I mean, they are not illusions. But to say that if this experience is true or not, this is not our area of experience. We cannot at least do that. Allah knows best.
Point, they have got some realities inside.
Definitely.
Them.
But when we see that a person comes and talks about his experiences, and they are really, he knows of what others do not know, and when they refer to the issue, then they see that, no, whatever he said was exact. You see, whatever he explained, I mean, about an issue that he has even never himself witnessed, we see that he actually defined it with the details of that issue. So it means that something happened. When you are told that, for example, you have a person in your family with such and such, let's say, characteristics, while you know that the other side who's talking to you has no idea of who you are.
Yes.
So you might come to understanding that, okay, there is something. Okay, even they can come even from different sources. We are not going to actually accept whatever is coming to us. So there is a possibility of some of this information coming from wrong, let's say, activities.
Yes.
Wrong practices. Mm-hmm. So, but to the extent that we are talking about the experiences of those people who passed this life, and not completely, because we might come, you might ask, like, okay, how is it like? Did they die? Yes, they did. They actually passed this life, but not completely, because if they die, they cannot come back.
You mean their soul has been separated from their body?
Definitely. The soul can be separated, even as the brother said, for even some of our scholars and mystics of Islam world, we know that even they willingly and unwillingly can separate their souls from their body. It's not a big deal. So based on the, even there are some practices that they do, and they actually exercise some, let's say,
some rituals,
and they reach to this this power that they can willingly depart from their body.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a big deal.
Yes, that's very true. So we hear most of these people who have such experiences, they say that I saw my soul in another dimension. I mean, I saw my body, but I was not in that body. So they give credit to that point, that the separation of soul from the body does happen. Now, the question is that how do they get to have those experiences in which he or she says that I have this ability to understand the language of others without talking to them? I would get to know plenty much of things without having to go inside their skin or talking to them or chit-chatting with them. So they talk about some special, unbelievable things that I would love to know your points about it.
Yeah, of course. Let me add a few points to what were mentioned by Brother Alavi. That is that we cannot call these kind of experiences as a kind of complete illusion. Because, you see, sometimes these kind of people who've had these sort of experiences, they talk about their forefathers. You know, for example, some of them talk about, for example, about their grandfathers or grandmothers. So while they have not seen them or they have not seen them.
And they then have their no fathers, idea about the people, some then, of the people they talk about.
And then their
about,
fathers
no
or their uncles or their mothers admit that, yeah, what you're telling about them, that's completely true. The characteristics, the features of that person. So, and also sometimes they tell the doctors, the nurses, that so you were there and those things were happening around me. That person was there. Mm-hmm. So all of them, when they examine, when they assess these kind of sayings, they found it completely true. So it since it is repeated and many people from different cultures, different societies say the same things, share the same kind of experiences, so at least we can say that it could not be illusion.
Yes, and yeah. I told you the yes. features they talk about, some of the features are very alike.
Yeah, of course.
Like
yeah.
the separation of the soul, like they could see their body, but yeah, they and like they touch things, but they cannot yeah. actually touch them.
Yeah, when it comes to your question that how is it possible to understand something, to perceive someone's ideas without having any kind of means of communication by language?
Yes, it there's seems no like
word,
a magic.
Yeah, there's no word, there's no language. Of course, since ilm or knowledge from the Islamic perspective, the nature of ilm is also, again, immaterial. It is mujarrat. It's yes. called understanding. Is something mujarrat that happens. It's immaterial. It is not something physical. It's not something bodily, I mean.
It's so, not tangible or vivid.
Of course, yeah, of course, yeah. So that is why it is possible to perceive something without having these kind of sensory kind of perception. I mean, by the sensations, without sensations. Directly you can understand something because there is a connection between mujarradat, between immaterial realities.
So as soon as the soul departs the body, these mm-hmm. things happen to it.
It might happen even when your soul is inside your body. Again, it is possible to happen. And also, the point that I should add here is that I think in these kind of experiences, near-death experiences, the complete separation or departure of the soul does not happen. I think still soul has some kind of connection or control over the body.
Yes.
If the departure or if the separation, once it's completed, then it is impossible for the soul to get back to the body.
Uh-huh. So that's the point. It is not completely separated from the body.
When a complete death happens, it is impossible for the soul to come back.
Then how come they could go to heaven or to hell? They see things like that.
Of course, as I told you, even it is possible that a person who is alive, if according to some of the scholars like Sheikh Ishraq, like many other mystics, they are of the view that if you purify your soul, if you perfect your soul, then you become able to perceive those sort of things that no one can see, no one can experience. Yeah. There is a very famous, a well-known kind of nice poem, which is said, in Farsi, it is said, Chashme del baz kun ke jaan bini, anjana didanist an bini.
So, open the eyes of your heart.
Yeah, yeah, of course, to see those sort of things that no one can see. Mm. So it is possible. It's not something so much shocking
so
or strange.
So it does not require the complete separation of the soul
yeah,
from the body.
Yeah, it does not require. Even when you are alive, even your soul, if it is inside the body, it is possible for you to perceive these sort of things.
So that's very interesting. Yeah. Now, speaking of the experiences they have in, they see a kind of, I don't know how to put it, stages of heaven or hell. How do you explain those things?
What do you mean?
I mean, we talked about the separation of the soul from mm-hmm. the body,
yeah.
and we said that it does not happen completely. Yeah. So how is it they see hell and heaven, and they could have some experiences from the other world?
Yeah, look, as I said earlier, in case we bring up our souls and spirits in the way that we have been asked. We can even do it, I mean, visit hell and heaven before we leave and we depart from this world.
But that's very unbelievable. It is called alam al-ghayb,
because we have been told, and this is among our worldview and ideology that we believe it. Because what is it that we are asked that mutu qabla an tamutu? What does it mean? Because we need to experience, this is a famous quote by Ayatollah Bajat, that he says, the person who has not experienced hell and heaven before he departs, he experienced nothing in his world, in this world. So what does it mean? It means that you need to experience. So does it actually bring us a duty to go and just to work on this separation of soul? No. If we keep piety and taqwa and be pious, slowly Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bestows us such things. You know? These are the natural outcome of piety. Mm-hmm. A person who actually cares for whatever is haram and whatever is wajibat and muharramat, whatever is compulsory and whatever is forbidden, naturally they are the outcome of such practices of taqwa. So, what is the quality and quantity of it? This is something that, since we have not experienced, we might not know about
that. It's the unknown.
But it is something that it does exist, because we know that some people do that and they can actually easily depart, and they can depart their soul from their body, and they can go and experience. I don't know if you have heard of the flight of the soul.
Yes.
This is common even in non-Islamic and even non-Western cultures, that they do agree. They can go and see an area and come back.
Mm-hmm.
So when you started going, I mean, as soon as your soul started going and flying towards different directions, so there is no border
possible
for that.
Yes.
There is no border for that. And when we are talking about hell and heaven, it is not something that, for example, we are going to another world and that hell and heaven are there. Hell and heaven is here with us.
Within us.
Manifestation of our good actions is heaven. Manifestations of our bad actions and, let's say, conducts are hell. So it is in this world with us, in the same world that we are. So it is not something, another world that, okay, after this, let's say, world, we are going to fly and we are taken and we are...
our bodies or
souls are going
journey.
To be taken to another world. No, it is here with us. So we need just to open our eyes and to see what is and exists.
The curtains must go away.
The curtains must go away, exactly.
So now, I'm sorry just to interrupt you. We're running out of time. Mm-hmm. We have to have a very wrap-up situation in which I will tell you that we're speaking of death and the separation of the soul from the body. And we talked about some very interesting stuff. Thank you for listening to us.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States seems to be failing to protect its people by the week. With the gun massacre in East Buffalo, followed by the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, many Americans have spent the past few days gripped by overwhelming incredulity and grief, exhaustion and fury over the loss of life. But what can be done beyond living with heartbreak? The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times and printed in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled, U.S. Leaders Are Failing in Their Most Basic Duty. The United States seems to be failing to protect its people by the week, with the gun massacre in East Buffalo followed by the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. Many Americans have spent the past few days gripped by overwhelming incredulity and grief, exhaustion and fury over the loss of life. But what can be done beyond living with heartbreak? There is incredulity at the inaction of the police in Uvalde, Texas. 78 minutes elapsed after the gunman walked inside before police, believing there were no kids at risk, finally confronted him, according to Stephen McGraw, the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety. Meanwhile, 911 dispatchers received several calls from inside the classroom, including repeated calls from a child begging them to send in the police. By the end of his rampage, the gunman had killed 19 children and two teachers at the Robb Elementary School. Stephen McGraw acknowledged the multiple failures of judgment. In response to a question about whether the commander at the scene should offer an apology to the victims' families, he said, "If I thought it would help, I would apologize." Police held back a group of horrified parents who gathered even as shots continued to ring out inside the school, and begged police officers to move in and try to rescue their children. At least one mother was put in handcuffs only to spring over a fence and sprint into the school to scoop up her child when the opportunity presented itself. The police, she said, were doing nothing. Those officers had been training for years for just such an attack. Yet, when the moment came, all that preparation did nothing to stop a gunman wielding an assault rifle in a school full of children. There is unspeakable grief over the deaths of children like Layla Salazar, who liked to make TikTok videos, wear denim jackets and sing Sweet Child O' Mine on the way to school each morning. "They took her away from us," Layla's grandfather, Vincent Salazar, told the New York Times. "How do you mend a broken heart from a family as close as we had?" Irma Garcia, a teacher at the Robb Elementary School, liked classic rock. Her body was found with children still in her embrace, according to her nephew. A fourth grader who survived the attack said that Miss Garcia and another teacher, Eva Mireles, had saved his and other students' lives. "They were in front of my classmates to help," he said. To save them. There is also a profound sense of national exhaustion that comes when tragedy is layered upon tragedy. In Buffalo, three funerals were held on Friday for victims of the mass shooting that took place at a supermarket on 14th of May. 10 people were killed in that attack and 3 others were wounded. It's like Groundhog's Day. We've seen this over and over again, Mark Talley, the son of one of the victims, Geraldine Talley, said at a news conference on Thursday, 26th of May. In Buffalo, a white gunman targeted a predominantly black neighborhood with his AR-15-style assault rifle. He was an adherent of the racist conspiracy theory known as replacement theory, which posits that white Americans are being displaced by immigrants and people of color. Nearly half of the Republicans told pollsters recently that they agree with the general thesis that a cabal of powerful people is encouraging immigrants to come to the United States to sway politics. The combination of paranoia and firearms has led to tragedy again and again. Why are we willing to live with this carnage? President Biden asked the nation on Tuesday, 24th of May. The report of each gunshot in a mass killing echoes long after the next killing eclipses it. According to his family, Joe Garcia, Irma Garcia's husband, died on Thursday, 26th of May, of a heart attack. Mr. Garcia, a 50-year-old, had just gotten home from the memorial for his wife on Thursday morning when he collapsed. It is entirely reasonable to ask how much more of this a nation can be expected to bear. The answer is infuriating. There have been 213 mass shootings in the United States in the first 21 weeks of 2022. An average of 321 Americans are shot every single day. And every day, there are roughly more than 50,000 gun sales recorded in the U.S. Properly maintained, those guns will fire like new for decades. There was some hope after a massacre at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012, which left 20 children and 6 teachers dead, that America had finally reached the limit of tragedy it could withstand, and that perhaps the gun lobby had reached the high water mark of its power. A decade later, neither of those holds true. On Friday, the former President Donald Trump, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota, and Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson of North Carolina all spoke at the annual convention of the National Rifles Association, NRA, in Houston, Texas, just a few hours' drive from Uvalde. There is no better manifestation of the gun lobby's total capture of so much of the Republican Party. States around the country have made halting but commendable progress in passing sensible gun safety measures, red flag laws, background checks, and age of purchase requirements. They face stiff headwinds. A federal court this month struck down a California law that set the age limit for purchasing semi-automatic weapons at 21. But the legislature is now considering other promising bills that would limit the advertising of certain guns to children and allow Californians to sue gun makers. Anything that introduces friction into the system of gun acquisition is to the good. In New York this week, a federal judge tossed out a challenge from gun groups to a law that allows civil lawsuits against companies that have endangered public safety. And New York Governor Kathy Hochul called on the legislature to raise the age limit to purchase some assault weapons to 21. The shooter in Texas waited until his 18th birthday to buy a pair of assault weapons and hundreds of rounds of ammunition. In Washington, D.C., there is talk that Republican and Democratic lawmakers might make a deal on some type of national red flag law, which would allow the police to take guns away from people judged to be in imminent danger either to themselves or to others. Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, has been leading a bipartisan group of senators that is considering establishing a more comprehensive federal background check system, a reform supported by 88% of the American public. We have seen these bipartisan efforts on gun safety measures come and go without results. Still, in the face of Republican intransigence, Democrats, and President Biden in particular, should do whatever they can. Senator Chris Murphy, who has led the charge for tougher gun regulations since Sandy Hook, put it well on the floor of the Senate this past week. "What are we doing?" he asked his colleagues. "Why do you go through all the hassle of getting this job, of putting yourself in a position of authority?" he wondered. "If the answer is to do nothing, as the slaughter increases, as our kids run for their lives." It's a question that speaks to the Senate directly, and the entire system of American government more broadly. Yes, the country's democratic system represents a diversity of views in the country on guns. But as currently structured, Congress is fundamentally unresponsive to the needs of its most vulnerable citizens, and has been corrupted by powerful interest groups, allowing those groups to block even modest changes to laws that the vast majority of Americans support. We, the American public, all share this vast country and need to figure out how to make it better and keep one another alive and thriving. Right now, we're falling at that primary responsibility. There are glimmers of hope, especially at the state level, that things are changing. But even there, progress is agonizingly slow and won't be enough for the hundreds of Americans who will be shot today and tomorrow and every day until action is taken.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.